Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to film sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Today you're going to hear an epic chat I did last weekend with NPR's own Netta Ulaby. And why is Matthew Sosi talking to Netta Ulaby? Well, you'll find out at the beginning of the chat in a little bit. She's been on the show before. It's been way too long since she's been a guest, and she was in town. So it was fun to have her in studio while we chatted things up. John Wick 3 opened this weekend. But still look for Amazing Grace while it is out there. A number of deaths in the last week, and sometimes it's just bad timing or good timing. But sometimes the timing is odd. But I had a house guest staying with us at the Sosi compound last week, and our friend Moretta had never seen the wonderful documentary The Celluloid Closet, which is a great documentary about the history of the images of gays and lesbians in cinema. Actually, Netta and I bring it up on this chat as well. And then a couple days later, Doris Day died. Again, we didn't plan it that way. But if you see the documentary, she's mentioned a couple of times in the documentary, one for her work in the 1950 jazz melodrama Young Man with a Horn with Kirk Douglas, young Doris Day, that was her fourth film, and Lauren Bacall. And of course, all of these sex comedies that Doris did with Rock Hudson in the 60s. Most notably, of course, 1959's Pillow Talk, which earned her only Academy Award nomination. I believe that won Best Original Screenplay that year. And if you haven't watched it in a while, especially in the height of the Me Too movement, go check that out again. You'll have plenty to talk about. But other notable titles, of course, Love Me or Leave Me, Calamity Jane, The Man Who Knew Too Much. If you'd find last week, Terry Gross on Fresh Air replayed her chat with Doris and talked about the song Que Sera Sera and its use in The Man Who Knew Too Much. Please Don't Eat the Daisies, Lover Come Back, Midnight Lace, That Touch of Mink, Move Over Darling, Send Me No Flowers, The Glass Bottom Boat, the last film of hers, of course, with Six, You Get Egg Roll. And yes, she was famous for turning down the role of Mrs. Robinson in The Graduate. I think especially when they were going after Robert Redford to play that. And I have to give my buddy Scooter credit for writing online, Dear World, I Died Too, signed Peggy Lipton, who best known, of course, for her work on The Mod Squad and Twin Peaks, but also appeared in Mosby's Marauders, more TV than film. But she also co-produced Rashida Jones, so thank you for that. Tim Conway also passed away rough week, as I said. And I want to be careful with this. I don't mean any disrespect toward the work of Mr. Conway, but I'll get to this analogy in a sec. My old boss, Bob Vavra, my second newspaper job, made a great comparison to the members of Monty Python's Flying Circus. And he said that being a member of Monty Python was the comedic equivalent of being a Beatle. and everything else those gentlemen were going to do after Monty Python is going to be measured up against the work on that series. And I think the same can be said for the members of the Carol Burnett Show. And Conway starred in a lot of films in the 70s, but I will ask you, if you had to choose between The Apple Dumpling Gang or The Prize Fighter or The Long Shot or The Private Eyes or any of those, or The Dentist Sketch or His Old Man Sketch, I think it goes without saying. So, and maybe it was one of those kind of like certain Saturday Night Live members where they are absolutely brilliant in 5 to 10 minute increments, but you don't necessarily have to have them carry a film. Now, Harvey Korman was a member of the Mel Brooks Players for a while. So anyway, I don't mean to speak ill, but when Tim died, I wasn't going for his 70s Disney output. I went back and started watching The Carol Burnett Show, but still damn funny. So thank you, Tim. Two-time Academy Award-winning screenwriter Alvin Sargent also passed away, won Oscars for his adaptations of Ordinary People and Julia, and also received a nomination for Paper Moon. Did a lot of TV in the 60s until started doing screenplays. His first one from, I believe, 1966, the Michael Caine caper film Gambit, Stalking Moon, The Sterile Cuckoo, I Walk the Line. The effect of gamma rays on men in the moon, Marigolds, Paper Moon, we mentioned, uncredited. You have to see what it is about. The 76 A Star Is Born, Love and Pain and the Whole Damn Thing, Bobby Deerfield, Straight Time, an underrated film right there. The Electric Horseman, Nuts, Dominic and Eugene, White Palace, What About Bob, the adaptation of Other People's Money, Hero, Bogus, Anywhere But Here, Unfaithful, and Spider-Man 2 and 3, as well as The Amazing Spider-Man. So thank you, Alvin Sargent, for that. And yeah, as at the morning of me recording this week's show, Grumpy Cat died at the age of 7. Yes, I own the Grumpy Cat Christmas movie on Lifetime. It was sent to me. I think I lost a bet. Aubrey Plaza is not the voice of Grumpy Cat in my world, but but it was a great excuse to post the Grumpy Cat face on the MGM logo. So there you go. All right, no more deaths this week. Here is my lively chat with NPR's Netta Ulaby. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology, an old friend of the show who hasn't aged one bit, direct from NPR offices in Washington with a brief stint in Ann Arbor. She didn't bring me Zingerman's. I'm a little disappointed. But Netta Ulaby is here, and she never disappoints me. Hi, Netta.
Hey, I'm bringing you Zingerman's in my heart. My heart is filled with Zingerman's for you.
It is no disrespect to people in New York, but it is my favorite delicatessen on the planet.
If you haven't been to Ann Arbor and you don't know about Zingerman's, just know that Zingerman's truly is an incredible delicatessen in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's also where I had my first job as a dishwasher.
Really? Oh, my gosh. And it was considerably a smaller place back then?
It really was. We are right now in a very small studio about the size of a very generous walk-in closet, and it's only a little bit smaller than Zingerman's was in those days.
So I'm sure Underwriting and Development is loving the fact that we're talking about Zingerman's, but that's okay. So I will get this a lot, but they'll say, why are you in studio with Matthew Soucy? But you had a way of mixing musical theater and public radio. So this is already after the fact, but tell us why you're in Indy.
And friendship.
Yeah, well, I love
because,
you too.
Because, you know, the story of public radio and the story of musical theater is ultimately stories of friendship.
Yes.
So, gosh, the reason why I'm here, Matthew, is because 10 years ago or so, I came to Indianapolis to do a story. WFYI, and you welcomed me into your hearts in the same way that Zingerman's is part of mine. And thanks to the good side of public media, social media.
Yes.
We've contrived to stay in touch. And a dear friend's father is mounting a musical in Indianapolis this very weekend. Unfortunately, listeners, you will have missed it, although I am trying to get Matthew to stage his own version. So consider this part of a new call-in campaign. You must at some point, if you have any shred of civic pride, see Indy the musical, A Hoosier Fantasy.
Yeah, Netta's trying to make it. I've told her that Pierce Brosnan is my vocal coach, and you want people to see this. So
how can you resist a show that has lines like this? 500-ND, 500-ND. And that is my Pierce Brosnan impression.
You could have been a jingle gal back in the 60s and 50s, or dancing cigarettes.
It may not be too late for me to do some dancing cigarettes.
So I know, speaking of Ann Arbor, and by the way, yes, I'm wearing the Zingerman shirt at work, but you were just, what, is a six-month residency in Ann Arbor?
It was a nine-month
residency.
Months. Yes. Oof. Yes.
So what were you doing in Ann Arbor?
Besides eating Zingerman's.
There's other food in Ann Arbor we know.
I was working on a book project that I'm sorry, I'm a little shy to talk about right now.
Fair enough.
A little vulnerable.
That's
about
okay.
My book project. I was doing something called the Knight Wallace Fellowship. It's a fellowship for journalists and taking classes, doing research, and hanging out with journalists from places like the BBC and the New York Times and the Dallas Morning News. There were journalists from Mexico, from Israel, from Korea, from Brazil. It was a pretty astonishing 9 months. I'm very grateful I got to do it.
I remember seeing the photo. I think you just returned back to your office.
Yes.
And all of the mail. Hopefully there was nothing perishable in the mail.
Well, one of my best friends sent me a tweet saying, I hope you found the frozen salmon I sent you back in October.
Very good. So I guess this is a film show, but did you partake in any of the art theaters in Ann Arbor while you were there?
Well, you know, University of Michigan does have one of the best musical theater programs for undergraduates in the country.
And hi, Priscilla.
Yeah, this is a fact. This is an absolute objective journalistic fact. So, you know, there are not many schools, I think, where someone who has no connection to the program would joyfully see many, many student productions. But joyfully, I saw every student production I possibly could.
Excellent.
You may have been asking about movies.
Yeah, either way.
You know, I did confess to Matthew before we started talking on air that because I was working on this book and because I was taking a break from
my job. You've been responsible.
Well, you know, I've not been on top of popular movies.
So we're not getting your input on Endgame?
Seriously, I think I saw the following movies. I'm not kidding. In the past year. And look, this is my job to see movies. So it seems, which God, I feel like a jerk just saying that, but it normally is. So I think the only fresh movie I saw was Us.
Oh, yeah.
I saw a lot of Korean film. I saw a lot of, I did a deep dive in Korean film for some reason, which was super interesting.
Did you enjoy Us?
I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't love it quite as much as Get Out.
That's a hard act to follow.
It is, but I admired it.
Yes.
Tremendously.
And it's interesting because there's a couple drive-ins in the state that the drive-in pairings have been Endgame and Us. I don't know I don't know how to feel about that.
Huh.
But what I liked about
pity, perhaps pity for the
white guilt. Yeah. Hi, welcome to no, but. I said this before, and this, and I know it's been out for a while, but I still don't want to give away anything. And if you've not seen a trailer for Us, good for you. But there are, like the films of Edgar Wright, who made mm-hmm. Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead, mm-hmm. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. He makes genre pictures so well, I don't need to see a genre picture like that for another 10 years. And there are two subgenre horror films that are represented in Us. And I don't need to see either one of those types for a decade. It's that well done.
What would you name?
If you've seen in the trailers, the kind of Purge, home invasion uh-huh. type thrillers. And the other half, I don't want to give away too much, but it's kind of the, not necessarily zombie stuff,
uh-huh. sure.
but
yeah.
There's a little Kubrickian. Mm-hmm. That's a word. It's NPR. There's some homages to Kubrick in mm-hmm. certain shots, like in the basement.
Absolutely, yes.
Are they live or are they Memorex kind of?
And to Orson Welles.
Yeah.
There's the Hall of Mirrors.
Exactly. So anyway, because it's so well done and it's a well-made genre picture, I think people are expecting another giant message film, and I can't wait to hear Jordan Peele's commentary on this. And I know he won't give us everything, but you can say this is this and this is that. And anyway, it's just a well done evening at the movies.
You know, I have a lot of friends who were scared to see Get Out, you know, and who are scared to see Us. And I will just say that these are also people who they saw The Shining. They've seen Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
They have seen. They are willing to see. You know, my feeling about a lot of genre is, you know, a lot of people don't like country music, but they love Patsy Cline.
Right.
A lot of people
or the old
love,
school stuff.
Right. They don't love opera, but they love the magic flute.
Right.
And horror is, I think, absolutely similar. You can hate horror, but still really enjoy Jaws. And I would put Jordan Peele's movies absolutely in that genre-defying category.
Your friends who are afraid of seeing this, would they have voted for Obama a third time?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah,
all right.
I mean, many of them are African-American. You know, it's that they are afraid. They don't like...
Hey, some of my favorite movies are horror movies. I'm film racism. I'm kidding.
But, you know, a lot of people have a visceral... literally a visceral reaction to scary movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that. I came late to scary movies. I don't really know what turned the corner for me. Actually, I do know what turned the corner.
Please.
It was Silence of the Lambs.
Okay. Wow.
Before that, I just did not think of scary movies as a category that was my
wheelhouse. Not your first choice, not your fifth choice.
And after Silence of the Lambs, I realized that scary movies did something to me as an audience member that I liked.
Well, there's... And as I alluded to earlier, we are of the same age range, although you look considerably younger than me.
It's because I artificially dye my beard.
But stop. I thought I was your beard. No. anyway, moving on before I get in trouble. But we grew up because I was 5 when Jaws came out.
You were
and
the same
that
age.
Yeah, so and that scared the hell out of me. And I also saw it in Long Beach Island, New Jersey. So
doubly
my dad
scary.
Took me to the beach the next day, lifted me over his head and hummed two notes and scared the crap out of me. Yep.
But Matthew, I will tell you, I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas. And
so children
I was,
in the corn scared the hell out of you.
Well, no, I was afraid to get into the deep end of the pool because Jaws was so scary. Well,
but then there was also the knockoffs where, you know, saltwater fish could kill in fresh water. All of the
Piranha.
Yeah.
Didn't John Sayles?
John Sayles.
Yep.
John Sayles wrote Piranha.
Yep.
Humanoids of the Deep.
Yes.
And all this stuff that Siskel and Ebert would bash on sneak previews way back when in the old PBS days.
Mm-hmm.
But I was And so anyway, that was a rollicking time at 5. And as I got older, much older, I was like, wow, a piece of celluloids did that to me. I remember seeing Halloween with my dad and my older brother, and I'm watching it through the two eyes. And
oh, confession, I also saw Halloween 2018.
Did you? Yeah. Oh, okay. So
I think those were the two movies.
That's fine.
Halloween 2018, which I loved.
So Laurie Peter, she was regular while she was killing Michael, trying to go after her. So,
right.
But you know, I'm watching it through fingers, and this was the first time I heard laughter at a scary movie, and I couldn't quite grasp why.
Wait, like a psycho laughing, or just like
no,
the
just
audience...
audience having a good time.
Yeah.
That's I didn't understand.
It's
that.
Like people laughing on roller coasters.
Yes, it is, and I'm not a roller coaster person.
Me
I'm
either.
The one who waves on the floor at Cedar Point.
Yeah,
so.
I'm the one who refuses to go to
there
Cedar
you
Point.
Go. But I think we grew up in a you know that period of the slasher movies, and then we went through the Krueger stuff in the
yep.
80s.
Yep.
So Silence of the Lambs for a lot of people was like the first. Grown-up horror movie. I don't
sure.
say adult movies because this is a family station. But yeah, I think that was like the first mature, big budget, big names type of scary film.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And one that had such a complex, it was so, I guess, in some ways, a very obvious relationship. The way it explored power, the way it explored gender.
Yep.
It was it was truly thrilling on every possible level, and it gave me in some ways the tools to go back and revisit some earlier true horror movies.
Cool.
And think about those also in terms of gender and power.
Do you remember what you watched?
Oh, sure. Like, yeah. I mean, I went straight to the classics. I saw, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I saw, you know, Halloween, which I'd never seen before. You know, Psycho. You know,
mm-hmm.
all of you know, The Birds. You know, horror movies speak. they speak to the experience of being a person.
Yep.
And in ways that I find and I think you do too, probably, if you're listening to this, that are playful, that are powerful, that are subversive, that
mm-hmm.
are scary.
I think also depending on, because, and I'm not going to turn this into therapy class, but I think everybody has their own fear. So if it's a one in particular, you know, we heard the stories of because of Psycho, you know, people showered with the curtains open or wouldn't shower, and, you know, just people wouldn't swim because of Jaws or. you know, people wouldn't go to small towns because of massacre. I mean, I think there's certain things that people have their own individual fears of, and some films can tap into that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure for some it's an adventure, and for others, like, I don't want to pay money to see, you know, my fears personified up on a giant screen.
There's something about empathy, you know, that speaks to me in horror movies. And, you know, I was doing a piece years ago about when Japanese horror was becoming a big thing.
Yes, and then they would get remade badly by the studios.
Yes, and one of the differences, somebody pointed this out to me when I was doing this early piece about J-horror. This was years and years and years ago. That one of the differences between horror movies, both in Japanese horror movies and Korean horror movies, I haven't seen horror movies from other countries, is that when somebody dies, when somebody gets killed by the monster, the lunatic, or whatever in these movies, people cry and they mourn for the person. And there's real sadness. And you contrast that to American horror movies where it's like, oh, so-and-so's dead, let's move on to the next.
Yeah.
And I think about that a lot, actually.
Did these films have a little more character development than the others?
Maybe we're
just an ugly society when it comes to the movies.
I don't know. I think that there's a kind of space in these movies for mourning and I think that when I first started watching them, I would think, like, do you remember, what is that movie, The Host, is it?
The Korean monster movie.
Yeah,
what a
right.
wonderful film.
Right. And do you remember there's a scene where everyone is basically at a giant memorial and people are just weeping inconsolably for the people who've been killed by the monster? And I remember watching that scene and thinking, oh, God, this is really slowing down the action.
And no, it's actually one of the more moving moments of the film.
It really is.
And so by that rationale would be like on November 1st in the John Carpenter's film, there would be a giant funeral procession afterwards.
Or, you know, even or in The Walking Dead, the TV show, like it never has, like somebody dies and everyone's like, oh, go up, pity about poor blah, blah.
And move on to the next
one.
And
move on to the next, yeah.
So I'm guessing you've never been chased and you've never fallen down while being chased. Like the old horror movie trope or... don't be half-dressed when you're seeing what the noise is down the hallway.
I am very fortunate to be a woman of my age who has never been in that situation. Yes.
What's that noise?
Yeah, exactly. Go check it out, Billy.
Yeah, so I think that's why. I mean, and which is why in the original Halloween, the fact that you did have a female survive.
Yeah.
And maintain through it. It's just like, you know, 10 years prior, you had an African-American gentleman who almost made it at the end of Night of Living Dead.
Oh,
almost.
Right.
And then one of the townies got him. So, I think, and it's been fascinating with stuff like Jordan Peele and other films where you're taking certain characters that we've grown up watching and you're doing a hopefully a different spin on it.
Yeah. Hey, have you seen the new Jordan Peele Twilight Zone?
I have not. Anyway, my streaming stories are another time or another place. Have you?
Well, the first one you can see on YouTube.
Oh, okay.
So I have seen the first one, and I thought it was absolutely tremendous. And I think we all have streaming stories, and I don't think anybody wants the CBS Express app. However, they were very smart, I think, to get Jordan Peele to put it just on that, because I, as someone who, like you, does not need another freaking app, I am planning on downloading it because I am on the Jordan Peele train.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's not a bad train to be on.
Yeah.
So going back a little bit, how long were you in Kansas?
We moved there when I was a little kid, and we left there when I was a young teenager.
Young teenager.
12 or 13.
What was your small town movie theater? Did you have the Last Picture Show? In Lawrence,
I was a little young for the Last Picture Show.
We all were.
We had the Cinema Twins that was hit by a tornado, and
oh,
I'm not kidding. We had two wonderful downtown movie theaters, one of which is now a very cool rock venue. The other one I'm not sure about. But you know, it's so funny, Matthew. Being of our age, there. When I remember hearing stories when I was a kid that the two downtown movie theaters, both of which had balconies, that Native Americans, there was a Native American college in Lawrence, is a terrific junior college. It was still segregated between Native Americans and white people, you know, in the early 60s, you know, less than, you know, about 10 years before my family moved there. It's so creepy to think about
that being that close to that era.
Yeah, yeah.
I grew up in Flint, Michigan, as we talked earlier. We had the Flint Cinema downtown, and that was in the 70s. That's where your kung fu, your blaxploitation, your Italian horror films were all down there. Genesee Valley was out in the mall near – that was the one closest to my home on the west side of the suburbs. See, Grand Blanc had a couple cinemas. There was a mall near Dort Highway. Dort Highway was scary. But Dort Highway also had the Flint Cinema, which was the largest screen. Right. I think if you didn't have the small town that, you know, you had the beautiful architectural movie theater in the town square, you hopefully had maybe on the outskirts of town or in the early incarnations of the mall, you had the large single screen. That's where I saw Rocky, that's where I saw Star Wars, I believe, that's where I saw Raiders. I saw Reds. I was 11 and I saw Reds.
It was
with just a big screen. Blade Runner, I believe, was another one. But, you know, it was an event.
Yeah.
And then we had there was an art house theater in the Detroit suburbs in the early 80s that
Ferndale?
I will have to check. But it's where I saw Diner. It's where I saw Montenegro with my dad. My dad was very easygoing on showing me stuff. We actually went to see My Dinner with Andre because Siskel and Ebert raved about it.
Yeah.
And, we walked out. I'm 12. And Dad said, "What'd you think?" And I was kind of flabbergasted. And I said, "I didn't hate it. I just couldn't believe somebody pulled this off."
Yeah.
You know, it hadn't fathomed me that a two-person dinner conversation could be made into a film.
It was you and I had very similar formative experiences. We had the Hillcrest movie theater that would show the – I'm air quoting edgier fare such as Dinner with Andre, Reds, Chariots of Fire.
Oh yeah,
I think that counted as a foreign film. But you know, in Lawrence, Kansas, we also had a active student film society.
Okay,
and so we were very lucky because we could go see big epic movies like Lawrence of Arabia, and they would have Hitchcock film festivals. Mm. And so that was an opportunity to see foreign movies,
yep,
classics, stuff that wasn't getting shown even at the relatively edgy Hillcrest Theater.
Grand Blanc, I remember, was where I saw my first Kurosawa film. They showed Kagamusha.
Oh, wow. I think I was in college before I saw a Kurosawa film.
I was, because it was another one. Siskel and Ebert raved about it and was like, "Oh, my God, it's here. We don't have to drive down to, you know, an hour away." And it was one of those, my dad fell asleep while watching it. He had had a long day at work, and I was enthralled by it. Then 5 years later is when I saw Ron, and I wound up, I couldn't believe how amazing it was. And then my freshman year at Ball State, they showed it on a big screen. So that was really my first big, big screen movie experience. No disrespect to Grand Blanc and Kagamusha. But you mentioned Lawrence of Arabia. The Fox Theater in downtown Detroit. This happened to a lot of cities where beautiful old architectural wonder gets dilapidated or turns into a porn house in the 70s.
Or both.
Dilapidated porn house. And then they revitalize it. And in the summer of 1989, one of the first events they showed, and I paid $10 in 1989 to see Lawrence of Arabia.
Wow.
With live organ accompaniment before and intermission and after. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
You know, I don't know if you've been to the Fox recently.
I have not.
I had the pleasure of going there, just in the past few months. And it has been so fabulously refurbished that I literally gasped when I walked in.
Oh.
It is no longer dilapidated nor a porn theater. It is just going there is an event.
Mm-hmm. That was my second one, because I actually was 14 when Passage to India.
Oh yeah,
the last David Lee, one with Alec Guinness.
Absolutely.
Casting problems have gone along back a long way. So
sure,
there
sure.
was that.
Yeah.
So what do you remember? What impressionable films happened to you as a youngster, whether it was in Kansas or Ann Arbor?
Boy, as a little kid, you know what? I think actually my taste for horror might have been sparked by Gremlins.
Oh, okay. All right.
Which is one of those movies that I think you go to, when we were our age, you went to Gremlins not knowing that it was actually going to be pretty scary.
Yes.
You know?
It was a little goofy, and then second one became more satirical, but
also
goofy in its own way.
But also, you know, I think scarier than I think people expected.
Right.
Boy, super formative. I mean, certainly Hitchcock was super formative. I loved slapstick, silent slapstick comedy. There was a show on television, on public television.
Yes, we're old enough that they used to show silent movies on TV.
On TV, and it was called Afternoon at the Bijou. And I was glued to Afternoon at the Bijou. And we had a television that's about the size of, I'm like, this is not helpful, about the size of a bread box.
This was back when there was more wood than television.
True. Although our television was so tiny.
So it was a TV, but it wasn't a piece of furniture with a screen wedged in.
No, because my parents had this idea of purity. And the only we could have a television, but the screen was less than 6 inches. You had to change the channel with pliers.
Took an hour to warm up.
Exactly. Yeah, we bought it at a garage sale. And it was used for the following purposes.
Okay.
Star Trek, Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers when we were little kids, and the news, and Afternoon at the Bijou.
Nice.
which my family found my interest in Afternoon at the Bijou completely mystifying. I still find my interest in it mystifying. Oh, and we watch PBS. We watch Mystery. You know,
we watch all of
upstairs,
say,
downstairs.
Back when Vincent Price hosted Mystery.
Yes.
With the Edward Gorey type intro. So I think Flint or Detroit Public Radio Television had sneak previews, and I think Mystery might have been the same night. I remember it used to be sneak previews, then This Old House.
Oh, yeah.
And this is when, you know, Bob would do the same damn thing. He'd walk through, hey, Bob, how are you? Hey, Jim, how you doing? Oh, hi, Bob. And, you know, Bob wouldn't help out. I'm working on a sink here, and you think you need help? And then, you know, he helps for like 3 seconds ago. He's like Mutual Omaha. Wow, you take care of that shower while I sit here with the camera. And
totally.
I believe Mystery was on later that evening.
You know, I just did a little obit for one of those Mutual of Omaha guys, Jim Fowler.
Yes, he just passed.
You know where he went to college?
Where?
Earlham.
Really?
Yeah, he was a beneficiary of a lifelong Quaker education.
Home of the Fighting Quakers.
The best mascot.
That's not a minor league sports team.
No, it's not. It's the actual, it's their actual mascot. Now, you know, Santa Cruz University.
Oh, the banana slugs. Oh, yes. Immortalized in Pulp Fiction.
That's right. I forgot about that.
And also,
it back to movies.
Would they fight the Cal Irvine Anteaters?
No, was it really
that? I'm not kidding.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
No, we also love, there's a few friends of ours that we love minor league sports teams because they can be ridiculous, like the Montgomery Biscuits.
Or the Toledo.
Mudhens.
Yes.
Thank you, Klinger. And the New Orleans Baby Cakes.
No, I didn't know that.
Not
one.
Kidding.
That's
not
great.
Kidding. So, yeah, there's whoever comes up with these, it's you're great. Did you watch the local horror show host? We, of course, here in Indianapolis have a famous one in Sammy Terry. Up in Detroit, we had Sir Graves Ghastly. Svengoolie, of course, is based out of Chicago and is now on MeTV. Not your wheelhouse
well,
as a kid?
As I said, you know, I didn't really get into horror until Silence of the Lambs, which was my sophomore year in college.
Okay, all right.
And yours.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, so and sometimes the horror show host was also the movie host, was also the kids host, and
right,
sometimes
totally,
all one in the
that
same.
That was a brilliant era. I did kind of have I did occasionally watch Roger Corman horror movies on those late night shows because I did sort of have a soft spot, especially for his hilarious Edgar Allan Poe adaptations,
which are just by name only at times.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
The Raven.
Is he going to go to a window? No, we're not doing that. Okay, we're not doing that. Why are there other people? Why is Peter Lorre here?
Exactly.
So, let me pick up this name I dropped. Yeah. I got to meet Roger Corman at IU Cinema. And he did a retrospect, and they showed, if I remember right, it was two of the biker films. I think it was the Wild Angels, one with Peter Fonda, Bruce Dern, Nancy Sinatra, Diane Ladd.
That's the one where they stick it to the man, right?
Yeah, that might have also been where Laura Dern was conceived, but I can't verify that, and neither will they. I think they showed two biker films, but the first two plays I ever directed had a combined budget of $200. The first play was $60. The other one was $140, only because I had to buy paint. And I kept saying, this is the Roger Corman in me. And I got to tell him that story and say, thank you for being an inspiration and keeping it on the cheap.
What was he like?
Very nice. He was, you know, was a fountain of old stories and name dropping. You think I name drop? He's really got it down. But you know, great old stories about the business and, you know, training young guys like Sales and Scorsese and Jonathan Demme and Jonathan Kaplan,
Ron Howard.
So all, you know, he was
he knew what he made, and pretty much everybody who worked with him knew what he made.
Yeah.
And it's a great training ground.
Well, you know, his cheapness was legendary.
Oh, yeah. Irwin Allen was impressed.
Yeah. I mean, there are stories. I cannot remember the name of this actor, but he would talk about playing both a cowboy and an Indian.
Yes.
In various Roger Corbin movies. I think he filmed Little Shop of Horrors in 2 days.
On a dare.
In like 2 days.
Yes.
And yep. I think they must have all been on cocaine, or at least Jack Nicholson probably was.
Something. But also the fact that some of those, especially Karloff and Price, mm-hmm. were, you know, for you young filmmakers out there, you know, they're only budgeted for a day or two. So you're going to film the hell out of them while you got them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, here's the ingenue and the big, tall, stiff guy, and you film them for whatever on the cheap. Yeah, those absolutely fun stuff.
Yeah.
We had Bill. I think I met Bill Kennedy was our afternoon movie show host in Detroit. Who I believe, if I remember right, Ascot and Beret, mm-hmm. that type. And was, you know, this was obviously long before Robert Osborne, but the monologue before and the little tidbits in between, and that was really cool as a young kid, mm-hmm. watching that stuff.
Oh yeah.
Did you go to the drive-in as a kid?
You bet. Oh, you bet. I mean. I hope that everyone listening has memories.
A drive-in experience.
Yeah, and I mean, piling in with your family and, you know, sticking in all of the pillows from the beds and,
yep.
you know, the kids falling asleep. So what was your most formative drive-in?
Towering Inferno and Young Frankenstein.
For me, the Twilight Zone movie.
Whoa. Ooh.
Scary as anything.
And that's because it's an anthology. So kind of, you know, some were obviously better than others. I'm guessing the John Lithgow one as Shatner.
Oh, the Shatner one scared the pants off.
The kid, the kid doing, I can't remember the kid's name, but it was Bill Mumy on the TV show.
Right.
And this was also the fact, you know, Vic Morrow had died.
You know, it's so funny to think about. There's actually an entire book that was written about this that I've really been wanting to read. But I bet you anything. What do you think, Matthew? I am guessing the ethics of today, that movie would not have come out.
No, it would not have. Yeah. No, not at all.
Yeah. Do you think it should have?
Oh, I think Warner Brothers would say yes. I don't. That's tough, because then you could think about if there's been any fatality on a film.
Yeah.
I remember a stunt double on. And I know there are other examples, but like Vampire in Brooklyn,
right.
The Eddie Murphy vampire movie, and that probably shouldn't have just come out because it was bad.
And there was that jazz movie that was getting made where the crew member died on the train tracks.
I thought it was about the Allman Brothers. Midnight Rider.
Exactly
so yeah,
right.
that
yes,
I know that one was shelved.
You're right.
Yeah, that's hard. And then you could go even further back and say how, you know, before we were informed that no animals were harmed
right.
in the making of this film.
Yeah.
And that really didn't pop up, I believe, until the
70s.
Right. So that's a tough call.
Yeah.
That's a really, really tough call. But then again, you know, Oliver Reed died while arm wrestling sailors half his age. And
that's a little different.
That's
a
little
negligence.
Different. Okay. That's true. That is true.
Yeah.
So. I don't know. Looking back, would you have released it?
I think no. Mm. I think, you know, it's one of the sort of like little internal Geiger counters. And while I love that movie and I don't like the idea of not getting to enjoy it, it makes me feel a little queasy inside. And
it's so the less we talk about Last Tango in Paris, the better.
Yeah.
Bad then to get the story confirmed, you're like,
but, you know, right. I love these kinds of conversations. I really mm-hmm. do. I love talking about, because people didn't take movies seriously, and they are so much.
They can be. They should be,
yeah.
I think.
And they are opportunities always, mm-hmm. right, to think about who we are.
Exactly. The new mystery for me, right now at the time of this recording, my favorite film of 2019 so far, and I opened with it before Avengers Endgame, is the Aretha Franklin documentary Amazing Grace.
Oh, my God, it's beautiful. I saw that one, too.
Yeah,
I'm just lying throughout this podcast.
But I know she had a cease and desist on the film being shown at certain festivals.
Really?
Yes. And I don't know why. I mean, the story behind it, for those who don't know, Sydney Pollack was filming the recording of Amazing Grace that was done in a church in Watts. And by some miracle fluke, Sound and picture did not sync up,
right.
And Warner Brothers shelved the film.
Right.
And it was only until a few years ago that technology had caught up and they were able to sync the film with the sound, and it was going to be ready to be released. And Aretha didn't want it released, but we still don't know why. And there were certain festivals it was going to play at, and Aretha's lawyers kind of did a cease and desist.
Wait, she didn't want it released at all?
At all. But we don't know why. So, dear Criterion, get going on this. And fortunately or unfortunately,
she died.
She died. God. And her family, I don't know, maybe her family, like the Jimi Hendrix family, just put it out there. And it is kind of one of the grails of unreleased cinema that, you know, old school film fans have been clamoring for, and it's everything it should be.
Yeah.
It's old school filming, you know, and I read reports early on that people were already lumping it in with The Last Waltz and Stop Making Sense and Gimme Shelter, and it's that good.
Yeah.
It's her at the height of her vocal powers.
Yeah.
It's long single takes, and yes, you see people, cameramen shuffling in the background, and you see Sidney Pollack pointing to people to direct, and watching Sidney Pollack clap along is so funny.
And a certain little known rocker.
Oh, Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts show up for that. Yeah, they capture. Yeah, and there's one. Film him.
Yeah.
So I'm really hoping it gets a bit. I mean, it's the fact that it's out here and it ran more than two weekends in India is a good sign.
It's a beautiful movie, and I've never seen her more beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, just her. Close-ups of her face covered in sweat, eyes closed, and just belting.
Transporting. It's
absolutely.
A transporting movie.
I love that stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The other thing that we were... Oh, so when did you go to Katharine Hepburn University?
I went to a small liberal arts college named Bryn Mawr. And one of its most famous alums was Catholic.
Is there a statue of her in pants outside the campus?
There certainly should be.
She would not have been there for the reveal, I know.
She actually hated it there. Her line was, I got into Bryn Mawr by the skin of my teeth, and by the skin of my teeth I stayed. There's a story about how on one of the very first days, it's an all-women's college, it is the Seven Sisters College.
Mm-hmm.
She thought that she had to dress for dinner, and she went into the dining hall wearing this like flaming red ball gown, and everyone mocked her, and she was terribly ostracized. And this is before she started acting,
right?
It's kind of the
ultimate just you wait.
Yes, but you know she evidently did end up loving Bryn Mawr enough so that she made some of the characters that she played be Bryn Mawr graduates in later movies. I think in The Philadelphia Story,
I think
her character is a Bryn Mawr girl.
Not a Muncie girl like Jennifer Jason Leigh in The Hudsucker Proxy doing her best Katharine Hepburn imitation.
But I will tell you something, and you may disagree with me. I don't know the last time it was that you saw Bringing Up Baby, which is a movie that I adored in high school.
Oh, yeah.
That I don't feel like that movie has aged well at all.
As far as some could say that's the grandmother of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Absolutely, it is,
and
100%.
And the fact,
although, come on, I mean, like Mabel Normand was a Manic Pixie Dream Girl,
right? We'll have to work on that family, the Manic Pixie Dream Girl tree,
yes,
and see where that goes.
Yes.
I have a dear hi Helen, my dear friend Helen, who's a college graduate and now working in Boston, but one of her boyfriends is still to this day Cary Grant. So
yes.
he and Hepburn had incredible chemistry together.
Yes.
And at the very least, that is fun to watch, even if, you know, some of the films are dated, because they are.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Did you ever watch Bond films speaking of gender roles?
I had a dad. Yes.
Made you watch him or just?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, my father also liked to think that he looked like Sean Connery.
And did he? Or is it more like Jason Connery?
You know, I think if you squinted from about, you know, four blocks away.
Emma got hooked on them for a while, and part of it was because of Spy Kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember showing her Goldfinger and Dr. No, and she's like, "Oh, that's where that comes from."
Right.
So, you know, the influences on that. One of the most fun experiences I've had in a movie theater as a dad was I got to see Skyfall at a press screening in advance, and it was I remember it was my number two film of the year. I think it should have been nominated for Best Picture. It was that good because it was well made. You had real actors. Sam Mendes was directing it. It's just a well made film and the best technically made Bond film ever. And part of it is technology and time and everything like that. But watching my daughter watch Skyfall at 12.
This is one of the reasons why I understand people have kids.
Yeah.
It's to pass on.
To pass on the stuff. And yes. and they don't always hit the – I've learned also with the kid, if you're going to show them your favorite directors, their best work is not necessarily the first place to start. Like my favorite director, Scorsese, her first Scorsese film was Hugo. Because I don't know if I want to inflict Taxi Driver or Goodfellas on him at a young age. Her first Woody Allen film was Midnight in Paris. So I'm like, that's fairly her. She's well aware of his history. So
the older Bonds, which is
she likes Sean.
But what about yours?
I'm a Sean guy.
Okay,
I'm a Sean guy. And I the first Bond film I saw in the theaters was The Spy Who Loved Me. So that's 78, and Ringo Starr's wife is in it. Barbara Bach.
Oh, right.
Barbara Bach was in that. But watching Emma, with the opening chase scene.
Now I know why you named her what you named her.
No, not that. We'll get to that in a minute. But also her finding out that Naomi Harris is Moneypenny. It was just fun watching her watch it. My wife and I, when it came to naming her, strong females, Emma Goldman, Emma Thompson.
Right.
We brought up Emma Peel, but I want mom to dress like Emma Peel, not her. and a little bit of Jane Austen,
Absolutely.
The busybody matchmaker.
Yep.
6 months after she was born was when the season finale of Friends happened. Jennifer Aniston had a baby.
Named Emma.
And named it Emma. And we got hit with calls all night going, "Did you watch Friends?" I'm like, "Oh, crud. Oh, I'm going to have to explain this."
This is what happens when you're ahead of the trend. I have a friend who's 12-year-old is named Liam, which seemed like a very unusual, cutting-edge name at the time. Although, come on, Liam Neeson was still a big star.
Yes, he was still, but he then became geriatric ass kicker. So.
And I think it's now like the second most popular name for boys. It's just, or it's definitely
that wouldn't
the top
surprise
five.
Me. Well, yeah. At least it wasn't because of Oasis.
Correct. It's pity.
Not too many people naming their kids Ringo. No, but there probably is that aspect of it. Yeah. But then again, parents have named their kids ESPN or ESPN sometimes.
ESPN.
If you're
boy.
Do you remember what films you watched in college? Because you were same time as me. When I graduated from college in 93, I went to Ann Arbor because I had a bunch of friends from high school that went there. Michigan was kind of my college away from college. Mm-hmm. And on a long weekend, not the lost weekend, but a long weekend, Bob Roberts, which, by the way, when it's election time, revisit Bob Roberts. The Tim Robbins film, as well as Election.
I should, yeah.
It was Emma's idea to watch Election every election night.
Oh, that's
no matter what it is, and I think that's a great piece.
And that's a great Indiana movie.
It is a very good.
Is it or is it?
That's a Nebraska one.
Nebraska movie. Sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a Midwesterner, so
that's all right. We have Angelo Pizzo and we have Hoosiers and Rudy, and we're all right. But we watched Bob Roberts, we watched Reservoir Dogs, and Bad Lieutenant.
Yeah.
Watching Bad Lieutenant with a bunch of guys, or really with anybody, that's I love Abel Ferrara. Not everybody loves Abel Ferrara. I will put it that way. All right. Did you have any awkward first date movies?
Oh boy! I mean, I think any first date that involved a movie would be an awkward first date.
There you
go. Don't you think?
Well, I think when you have a one or maybe a two in your age and the imagination fountain hasn't quite kicked in, how about that?
Boy, I'm going to have to give that one some thought, Matthew. But I'm guessing you're asking because you have had.
Oh, sure, I had. Because as a film nerd, you're thinking more about the film itself than what kind of effect would the film have on her or him.
I do remember going and seeing this. It wasn't a date, but my freshman year roommate and I went and saw The Cook, the Thief, Her Life, and Her Lover together.
Really?
And she walked out, and I was ready. I mean, I was kind of in it. I was like ready.
The most memorable dish in that film, and it wasn't Helen Mirren.
It was a pretty memorable dish. So, yes, not a
wow.
date, but that was a... And I remember I wanted to stay, and I ended up having to leave because she had the car. But what about you?
Speaking of Ball State, so it happened at Ball State, and there was a Ball State graduate in this film, Ball State graduate Cinda Williams. Mm-hmm. She was one of the lovers in Spike Lee's Mo Better Blues.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh.
Yep. And she's done a few things since, but she was in a film called One False Move.
Oh, I love that
movie.
Yeah,
Billy Bob Thornton, who co-wrote it and was in it.
Right.
Directed by Carl Franklin. Bill
right.
Paxton was mm-hmm. the name in it. And it's a some shady characters from L.A. meeting up in a small Arkansas town. The feds are waiting for them. Bill Paxton is a local sheriff who wants to assist and have a bigger impact. And there was a girl at the Ball State Daily News who I wanted to date big time. And I had no imagination, so I would go to a movie. And I said, there's a Ball State grad in it. So we get to the movie, and the very first scene is a house full of people in inner city Los Angeles who are invaded by these criminals, tied up, plastic bags over heads, and uh-huh. that was the opening of the film. And she looked at me like I peed on the floor.
Oh God!
And
I'm like, I mean, that's a fantastic.
It is
movie.
A great film, not yeah. a great first date
no,
film.
No. What's the worst first date film?
That isn't it. Let's see. I had a my buddy, who I shouldn't name, took a first date to Platoon.
That's a tough
because he
one.
Loved Oliver Stone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought I'd be smart and say you pick, and she picked Cape Fear.
Oh yes. Well, yes. That's yep.
I think I'm gonna say she just heard it was a good scary movie.
You know, I think most. Let's just say it. Any movie with sexual violence, maybe not the best first date.
No,
movie.
definitely not. But
I think you're still getting to know each other.
So, but the thing with One False Move was I a year later got to interview Cinda Williams for the Ball State Daily News because she came back to speak to the theater department and she laughed at me.
Wait, what became of her? Because I remember
she
was a wonderful
She did
actress.
A number of films, and I know she is now she's a mom and family lady. She actually performed at a tribute for a faculty member at the Ball State Theater reunion this past spring. But
uh-huh.
I think she's still doing stage work in and around the Chicagoland area,
oh,
if
awesome.
I remember correctly. So,
Very
one
cool.
of those that lady,
yeah.
that guys. We're pro character actors here. At the Film Sociology, or as my wife says, all actors are character actors.
Your wife would be correct.
Yes, and my wife and I, I had her pick, uh-huh. and her first film with me was To Jillian on her 37th birthday, which was a play she knew, and it's Peter Gallagher is a widower. Mm-hmm. He's spending the summer it's the first summer without his wife. He's with her daughter and family on the beach, and the mm-hmm. ghost of his wife keeps bothering him. The ghost of his wife, played by Michelle Pfeiffer.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife knew how I felt about Ms. Pfeiffer.
Uh-huh.
And the smart one has said, I looked at her and said, well, you know who's in this? And she's like, yes. And I said, you're okay with this? And she's like, yeah, because the movie's going to be over in 2 hours, and I'll still be sitting here.
Uh-huh.
Lynn's a smart one, she
Wise
is.
Woman.
So, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD 2 The Point. And Netta Ulaby from NPR is hanging out with me. Do you remember the first film assignment you had for NPR?
Oh, gosh, for NPR. You know, I was a film critic before.
Where?
For a newspaper called the Windy City Times in Chicago.
Oh, yes.
Which meant
yes.
I went to film screenings with
the big two.
Siskel and Ebert.
Yep. And they had their own spot.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't.
Oh, no.
Were they approachable?
Yeah, ish. I didn't want to be. First of all, there were not a lot of women. There were three women.
And
you
were the youngest?
Oh, by far.
Yeah, so that's.
So I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be super.
Clingy.
So I tried to play it cool, but what was kind of funny is I was working for the Gay and Lesbian newspaper, and they would make a point of talking to me whenever we saw a movie with any lesbian content.
Oh, you're the consultant.
Yes. After Boys Don't Cry, for example, they would say, Netta, what did you think about this?
Is it accurate?
They didn't ask me.
It's not a documentary, okay?
They didn't ask me about, you know, any other movie about my feelings, but if there was a lesbian in it, my opinion was solicited.
you're welcome.
Hey, I mean, it was a thrill to be in the room with him. Although I will also, my favorite Roger Ebert story was we were watching, they were screening one of the Austin Powers movies. Maybe it was the first Austin Powers.
Okay.
Movie. This was a while ago. And there was some reference to Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Which
Ebert wrote.
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Beyond the Valley of
yes,
the Dolls.
Yes, it's my happening and it freaks me out. Yes,
right.
that's used in the first one.
Yes, and Ebert stood up and apparently with no irony whatsoever, he was like, this shouldn't be allowed. That's my line. And he stormed out.
Oh, my God.
And I think he later gave the movie a fine review, but
didn't see it coming.
Either that, or he was performing for us. I didn't
probably.
Quite know. Yeah, I'm not sure what, but he really sort of made a point of being.
I'm assuming you've seen Life Itself, the Roger Ebert documentary that Steve James did. Okay, first of all, that was my top film of that year, and I love Steve James, the man of Hoop Dreams fame.
Yeah.
But it's. It really goes into the relationship between Siskel and Ebert. And there's even outtakes. That was fun. That they verbally jabbed at each other constantly.
Yeah.
And they had two distinctly different lifestyles. So the fact that you told that story, my guess was Siskel was just going to lean into him on, you know, how much did you pay the guys to say that in the movie? So maybe he staged that for everybody just so, I don't know, but that's pretty good.
Know. Yeah. I
wow.
mean, I was like 25, you know, like, yeah.
My first job in Chicago, I was a driver for the film festival and they were honoring the two of them. I got to meet them individually.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to them, because he's like, oh my God, you got like 2 minutes, don't screw it up.
Right.
And I told them both I was from Flint. Mm-hmm. And they both genuinely, because they loved Roger and me.
Yeah.
And, you know, they asked
how they helped to make Roger.
Yeah, they did. They were huge. And, should never be forgotten how big of an influence these guys were.
Absolutely.
And, I've been telling.
Spike Lee.
Yeah. Jim Jarmusch.
Yep.
If these guys raved about it, I would bother my dad and, Dad, let's go. We got to see this. So, I mean, it's very old-fashioned, but it was that simple.
Yeah.
So I got to tell them about Roger and me because, I was 20. Four and I didn't know any better, and then I wrote briefly for Film Threat, and
cool.
I got to cover the Chicago Film Critics Awards, and I saw Roger again. And did you don't remember me, but I remember you. I actually got to correct Roger on one of his film rules.
Oh,
and because if you've seen his books, he has great books about movie terminology glossaries that he has created. The idiot plot and fruit cart and that sort of thing. And he had a rule, the Harry Dean Stanton and M. Emmett Walsh rule. Any film with these two actors can't be all bad. And I said, I just saw Never Talk to Strangers. It was a bad Canadian thriller with Rebecca De Mornay and Antonio Banderas. And Harry Dean was in it. And it was that bad.
Wow.
And I thought, well, that's going to take serious onions to say that. And he immediately shot back with, that's okay. I just found out recently one of my big rules is also wrong. And I went, oh, which one? And he said, no good film has ever had a scene with a hot air balloon. And I went, well, what's the exception? The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
I went, yep. Okay. I immediately thought of, yes, Giorgio, the one and only film starring Luciano Pavarotti.
Oh, yeah,
like, yeah, there's a balloon scene in that. That's pretty awful. So anyway, he was nice enough that, and of course.
Is that really the only?
Well, maybe that's your project. That's our project.
Yeah.
Films with hot air balloons scenes. It's like my little project is any film set in a downtown area, I always see what the marquee has.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because you know that that's intentional.
One of the great inside jokes is in the first Dirty Harry when he's thwarted a bank robbery and the marquee behind him, because there's a scene, he's hit a hydrant and there's water and he's walking through it. And the marquee says, play Misty for me.
Nice one.
Yeah. I was
nice
like, ah, oh, we see what you did. Because usually if it's organized, or it will be a film done by the same studio. There's a Burt Reynolds car movie called White Lightning,
mm-hmm.
and there's a car chase in a small town, and it goes through, and he does a fast turn, and there's a theater, and it was skyjacked. It was an MGM skyjacking movie with Charlton Heston, and you know, it was Airport but cheaper. But yeah, one of those things. And it was fun because then you could tell if they shot it on the cheap or they shot it fast without permits. It didn't care what was on there. Yeah. You could see all that stuff.
Yeah. But it's funny talking about influential film critics. I remember driving down the street in Chicago and listening to NPR's movie critic, Bob Mondello.
Give a review. Great voice.
He was reviewing Jim Jarmusch's Ghost Dog. And as I was driving down the street, I drove past the theater that was showing it, and I did a U-turn.
Really?
I went straight to the theater, I bought a ticket, and I watched it because Bob's review was so good. And I got to tell you, Matthew, that I can now say with full authority that Bob Mondello is one of the sweetest people on the planet.
Yay!
He is not only a genius, and I really mean this, genius film critic. He is a really genius person.
He is. I mean,
have you ever met him? You should get him
not.
On your show.
You should tell him about my show.
Yes, okay. I probably have. You should have him call in from Washington.
Oh my gosh! This is how I did this with Netta. But yeah. What I love about Bob's stuff is it's very. I mean, because 2 minute reviews.
Yes.
And
sound
he,
rich.
Are hard.
Yeah.
They're
and he
really
packs
and he
with
packs
sound.
It in, and the use of sound from the film is really good. Because it's shorter than the Fresh Air stuff, and I, you know, I need a whole hour to talk about stuff sometimes, and I, you know, it's hard.
The cutest
so.
Thing I can tell you about Bob is he feels his feelings when he reviews so powerfully that he occasionally makes himself cry.
Oh.
When he's doing his reviews.
Wow.
Sometimes people have to make Bob retake because he actually manages to choke himself
up.
Oh
my gosh.
It's so cute.
You mentioned Chicago, and we were both in Chicago at the the same time, but we were in completely different circles. But I fell in love with the Music Box.
Oh yeah. Great.
What great theater. Art films. Midnight movies on the weekends and Saturday, Sunday matinees.
It's hard to believe that we were in completely different circles. Like, I was really good buddies with Jay, whose last name I'm forgetting, who ran the Chicago Underground Film Festival.
Yeah, I never did that.
Those are your people. Those are your people.
I got to go to one, I did a piece for Film Threat on Fred Williamson. I actually got to be on location in downtown Gary, Indiana
awesome.
At night while he was shooting Original Gangstas.
Wow.
And Fred is sort of a friend. He's somebody I've had on the show a few times. Mm-hmm. I got to smoke cigars with him in Palm Springs.
That's pretty cool.
And he introduced me to Larry Cohen. Skypoint to Larry Cohen. Mm-hmm. But I got to cover that. And because of that, I got to cover the Chicago Film Critics Awards. And I got to do, like, you know, I was in the press corps doing one question if I was lucky. And then went to the award ceremony itself. It was Bonnie Hunt and George Wendt were the host. Uh-huh. Gary Sinise got the Career Achievement Award. But it was very brief. And then I believe Film Threat switched management. And then I never got it again. Uh-huh. So... But yeah, the Music Box. So the guy I used to live with when I first was working with the festival, I mean, he was about a 5 minute drive from Music Box, mm-hmm. and I saw a number of Bond films at midnight. Uh-huh. I dragged my wife there to see Superfly.
She's a
really patient woman. I made her watch. She had never seen Blaxploitation. She had never seen Kung Fu. She had never seen a Hammer horror film. Mm-hmm. Her tastes are a little better than mine, but there is a little different.
I love but all of those kinds
there's
of
enough similarities in the middle. Mm-hmm. I call it the MasterCard logo. You know, there's enough stuff that we both love in
diagram.
There. But I dragged when we were recording. I dragged her to I made her go to Buddy Guy's Legends, which was loud and smoky. And
that's a great place.
It is. It's not
As
her
a matter
thing.
Of fact, then the New Yorker just did a big thing about Buddy Guy.
Yeah,
a really beautiful
he's still,
piece about
still
him.
With us.
Yeah, the last of that generation.
Yep. And the last time I went to the Music Box, I took Emma. Uh-huh. I made her go to the festival with me for a couple of days. And we went to a matinee with live organ accompaniment. I can't remember the film, but it was the one and only time Gloria Swanson and Rudolph Valentino did a film together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was
See,
really,
now we're
really cool.
My real
That's your wheelhouse
spot.
There? Yeah.
You know, I love those really old movies. And it was probably, was it Silent?
Yeah, it was Silent. Yeah. Yeah. So 11:30 in the morning and got in there and it was just so much fun.
Yeah.
But the fact that place is still thriving, I remember... going to a 20th anniversary new print of Taxi Driver. Mm-hmm. And the moment when you see De Niro with the mohawk, and certain members of the audience cheered and they're like, I don't want to be near you guys when we walk out of the theater.
Those are the people who laugh unironically in horror movies.
Or, yeah, kind of. Yeah. That's a little much. Who are you? I would say so. Speaking of Gloria Swanson, were you an SNL watcher?
I think like many people, it depends on who the cast is. And
this is the power of SNL and this job. Uh-huh. There was a period when Emma was younger that I would take her with me to work on a Saturday. And the deal was she had to watch. We would come in early like this, for those who are listening to this when we recorded this. But we'd watch one movie, one old movie of my choosing. And then I said, then you can go to the desk and on my desk and watch YouTube clips for the rest of whatever. But there was about maybe four or five sketches that Bill Hader did as Vincent Price, and he's hosting a Thanksgiving special, two Christmas specials, a Halloween special, and of course the players and the guests are all impersonating. And there was a Halloween one, and he's wondering, if his famous friends will show up in costume, and if you can recognize them, and the doorbell rings. And he says, I hope it's not a pirate or a spaceman. And you open it up, and it's John Hamm as James Mason and Kristen Wiig as Gloria Swanson.
Oh, how fun.
In her sunset garb, just going, "Arg, I'm a pirate." And where's your costume? I don't need a costume. I'm an actress.
Oh,
and that made Emma want to watch the film Sunset Boulevard, which we did. So,
one of the greatest movies.
Yeah. And to this day, Emma and I will look at each other and kind of cross our hands and open our eyeballs real big when we look at each other.
That's great.
So do you remember you were talking about – so your wheelhouse. We're talking 30s, 40s, 50s kind of early.
I love movies of the teens.
Yeah?
I name dropped my Mabel Normand, one of my favorite actors of all time. I'm a, Buster Keaton groupie. Mm-hmm. If I could be, I would
You can do that.
I worked on a dissertation about Fatty Arbuckle.
Really?
So, yeah. Early,
talk about a guy.
Yeah. Yeah, look, Fatty was framed. I think we.
Yeah?
I think we all know that now.
Man,
William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah, that's somebody not to trifle with.
Yeah.
Yikes! Yeah, that's tough.
I love those old movies. Those really really old ones. And Fatty Arbuckle was a comic genius.
Do you think his stuff will ever get re-released?
Well, you can find it.
But is it restored? Like, I don't know if Criterion type stuff, or is it Kino?
A lot of it was Keystone.
Okay, Keystone.
He was a Keystone artist, his career took a dive.
Oh yeah.
And he didn't. And did you know that after the trial, he did continue to work under the pseudonym Will Be Good?
Really?
Buster Keaton gave him directing jobs, and he didn't appear on screen. But he
did not know. Yeah. How long did that go on?
Not long. He didn't live for a terribly long amount of time after that trial. That was the first huge celebrity trial.
Yeah.
And it it affected the newspaper business. Newspapers were printing as many as two or three editions a day.
Hearst
newspapers.
Right.
Covering the trial.
The original 24-hour news cycle, sort of.
It was just a very sad story. And what probably happened, and at this point, no one, of course, knows for sure, but it's very likely that the woman that Fatty Arbuckle was accused of raping, and one of the first huge Hollywood scandals, probably what had happened, and the story, if your listeners don't know, is it's a very lurid story, but there were various versions of it, but essentially, that he either penetrated her with a Coke bottle. And,
yeah, the Coke bottle is the one
that
I know of.
Or he squished her.
Which could happen regardless, so.
But it's very, very likely that what happened was she had procured an illegal abortion, and that was what, in fact, had killed her.
Oh, boy.
Really, it's a really, really sad story.
Nobody's making a biopic on Fatty anytime soon.
No. It would be very difficult to do that.
That would be really hard.
Yeah, but about 10 years ago, there was this sort of flurry of interest in Fatty, and a novel came out about him. And, his is a truly interesting story. It's just, biopic probably not so much.
What inspired you to do the dissertation? Because of the scandal? Or was it also, in a way, to present him in the original light?
It was partly because it was a combination of things. I love him as a performer. I was fascinated that the trial that led to, that he got tried twice, and he was not convicted. He was let off both times. It led to the forming of what was called the Hays Code, which became our rating system.
Yep.
And movies had really been a free-for-all prior to this in terms of what you could show. There was homosexuality on screen. There was, there could be
nudity. I mean, between the Tarzan films of the 20s and the Sodom and Gomorrah type pictures.
Yeah, and a lot of times, of course, it was in the context of these Bible movies. Like, so don't do what we're about to show you.
Yes, exactly. Hi, GOP. No.
But Will Hays, who's also one of the founders of the post office.
Yes.
Was also the person who created the rating, the contemporary.
Indiana guy.
Oh, that's right.
That's right, because I just revisited a documentary and introduced it to my friend who had not seen it, but the Celluloid Closet.
Oh, that's a fat, yes.
Great documentary about the history of gays and lesbians image in cinema.
Yes.
And there's a couple of Indiana references to it. Great.
Yeah.
But it's funny, that film came out 20 years ago, and I would love, dear Criterion, I would love a second disc with an update. Because I think the film was, because it's based on a book, film came out, and I saw it at the Music Box in 1995, because they had just talked about Philadelphia and the wave of independent films from the 90s. And I'd love to, not necessarily a part two, but a supplement to go with that in the last couple decades.
And
since.
Sadly, the historian who did it, Vito Russo, is one of the was a casualty of the AIDS crisis in the 90s. Yeah.
But Fatty Stuff is still available on home video?
Almost definitely. I saw it. I mean, I worked on my dissertation long enough ago so that it was mostly the stuff I watched was on VHS. But, you can watch a lot of the stuff on YouTube.
And how was your – obviously, you were successful. You had a good defense of your dissertation.
No, I never finished it.
Oh, you never did?
So it was that successful.
Oh, okay.
But, all right. Yeah.
Well, Netta, I know we're time is short and time is fleeting and there is a season, turn. But I know we will do this again, even if it's on the phone.
I will absolutely count on it, or studio to studio.
Studio to studio. But, Netta, thank you so much for your time.
Matthew, this was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie, you deserve it, or check out any of the films by those we mentioned earlier on the show. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. And thanks, Doris.
I had a secret love that lived within the heart of me. All too soon, my secret love became impatient to be free. So I told friendly star the way that dreamers often do, just how wonderful you are and why I'm so in love with you.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!